Es ist wieder Zeit für Beyond. Es geht in die Tiefe.
It's like we can pretend that life is all about planning and strategy and things like that, but actually life is more emergent. Serendipity comes from something where most of us would say, this is a crisis, this was a bad thing. But I think meaning-making it makes it really interesting, because then you look at every crisis and you're like, you know what? Can I still find some meaning in there? And it's not toxic positivity. It's not saying everything is great. No, everything is not great. Life is painful. Life is hard. But can I still find some meaning in that moment so that I look back and say, I did something with that moment?
Herzlich willkommen zu Brand Trust Talks Beyond. Der tiefgründigste Blick hinter die Kulissen von Marken und deren Machern.
Hallo liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen zurück zu Brand Trust Talks Beyond. Es geht wieder in die Tiefe und natürlich habe ich mir dafür auch wieder einen spannenden Gast eingeladen. Und zwar niemand geringeren als Mr. Serendipity, nämlich Professor Dr. Christian Busch. Er ist der führende Experte im Bereich der Forschung zu diesem Wort und zu dieser Thematik der Serendipität oder eben im Englischen Serendipity. Und falls ihr euch jetzt fragt, was das ist, dann müsst ihr erstmal den Podcast hören. Aber ganz, ganz verkürzt dargestellt bedeutet es eigentlich, wie man das Unerwartete und auch das Thema Glück und Zufall, wie man das unter anderem in sein Leben, aber natürlich auch in die Unternehmens- und Markenführung gewinnbringend und vorteilhaft integrieren kann. Und wenn jetzt noch nicht alles gesagt ist oder ihr jetzt nicht schon gespannt seid auf den Talk, dann kann ich noch ein paar kleine Ausblicke geben. Und zwar könnt ihr euch darauf freuen, dass ich mit Christian natürlich genau darüber spreche. Wie kann man denn dieses Thema Glück und Zufall, gerade in der ja so unkontrollierbar wirkenden Welt von heute, wie kann man das denn da eigentlich integrieren? Wie funktioniert das denn wirklich in der Praxis, das da auch wirklich reinzubringen in die Unternehmensführung und was kann das auch für Vorteile bringen? Dann spreche ich mit ihm auch durchaus kritisch über zwei Punkte, nämlich ob denn sowas wie Glück und Zufall nicht einfach irgendwie ein Privileg ist, gerade für Leute, die eben Privilegien haben. Und ob nicht vielleicht das Ganze auch eher so ein Mindset-Thema ist und dementsprechend auch eine Abgrenzung Thema Toxic Positivity notwendig ist. Weil wenn man Christian so zuhört, dann merkt man schon, das ist ein Mindset-Thema und da geht es viel darum, wie man sich denn auch aufstellt, gerade wenn man auch Krisen und Herausforderungen gegenübersteht. Und da kann man dann schnell so den Eindruck bekommen, ja, das hat nur was damit zu tun, dass man sich entsprechend einstellt. Aber weit gefehlt, Christian versteht es wunderbar, da richtig Tiefe und vor allen Dingen auch Wissenschaft reinzubringen und das Ganze hervorragend darzustellen, warum eben Serendipity nicht nur irgendwie ein Trend ist oder eine lose Idee, sondern etwas ist, was wissenschaftlich fundiert ist und was vor allen Dingen auch in der Praxis funktioniert. Dementsprechend könnt ihr euch jetzt auf ein unglaublich spannendes Gespräch, vielleicht sogar eines der besten Gespräche, die wir hier jemals aufgenommen haben bei Brand Trust Talks Beyond, freuen, weil es wirklich komplett in die Tiefe geht, wie wir es ja hier auch immer anstreben. Und zweitens, weil es unglaublich praxisnah, fundiert und einfach grundsätzlich spannend ist. Das ganze Gespräch ist fast auf Englisch. Am Anfang sind wir im Deutschen, weil Christian tatsächlich Deutscher ist, auch wenn man es fast gar nicht mehr hört. Aber ich glaube, gerade hinten raus im Englischen wollten wir dann die Folge aufnehmen, weil es dann doch noch authentischer und noch mehr in den Fachbegriffen auch bleibt. Dementsprechend freut euch auf ein unglaublich veränderndes, für mich auch veränderndes Gespräch mit Professor Dr. Christian Busch. Viel Spaß dabei. Hallo liebe Hörerinnen und Hörer, willkommen zurück zu Brand Trust Talks Beyond. Es ist mir eine Freude, heute Christian Busch bei mir zu haben. Grüß dich, Christian.
Hallo, freut mich hier zu sein.
Super, lass uns mal direkt reinstarten. Christian, du weißt ja, du darfst erstmal mit 4 Einstiegsfragen starten und die machen wir auf Deutsch. Später switchen wir ins Englische, da kommen wir aber gleich später drauf, warum das denn so ist und woran das liegt etc. Aber jetzt starten wir mal mit dir als Person. Ich würde mal gerne bei dir damit anfangen, dass du mal beschreibst, was machst du denn in einem Satz und ohne, dass du deine berufliche Profession schon verraten darfst. Wie würdest du das beschreiben, was du tust?
Ich habe sehr viel Freude daran, Punkte, Ideen zu verknüpfen, Menschen zu verknüpfen und dann so dieser Spark, der davon kommt.
Sehr gut, ja, das kann ich mir vorstellen. Da gehen wir später nochmal gut rein. Dann fangen wir mal mit dem Spark aus deiner Kindheit an. Hast du eine Lieblingsmarke der Kindheit, wenn du dich an deine Kindheit erinnerst?
Ich habe eine Marke, die mir sehr im Kopf geblieben ist von damals. Und zwar, ich bin ja in Heidelberg aufgewachsen und von der Schule geflogen und habe das dann auch so in meinen Fahrstil übertragen und so und hatte dann einen riesigen Autounfall, der mich fast umgebracht hätte. Und Volvo damals hatte diese extra, also die hatten so Türen, die so extra Safety waren und so, und das hat mir da das Leben gerettet. Und deswegen war Volvo immer so bei mir. Volvo hat sich bei mir irgendwie so festgesetzt als Lebensretter.
Das kann ich mir gut vorstellen. Das ist auch mal eine sehr emotionale Story. Ich glaube, auch Volvo als Lieblingsmarke der Kindheit haben wir, glaube ich, noch nicht gehabt, muss ich ehrlich sagen. Meistens oftmals Lieblingsmarke heute und das ist vielleicht auch die Überleitung. Hast du aktuell eine Lieblingsmarke? Du wohnst ja in Los Angeles in den USA, bist zwar überall unterwegs, aber meistens in den USA. Und gibt es da irgendeine Lieblingsmarke, die dich so berührt, bewegt?
Ist eine sehr persönliche auch. Und zwar, das ist Happiest Baby. Das ist, die machen Snoo. Das ist so ein Robotic Baby Bed. Also die Idee ist, normalerweise, wenn du Babys hast, und wir haben ja gerade geredet, wir haben ja beide zwei Kids, ne? Und wenn du Babys hast, die gehen ja schnell auf den Bauch und dann können sie quasi suffocaten, also kriegen keine Luft mehr. Und da geht es darum, die so sicher auf den Rücken zu machen. Und dann, es ist so künstliche Intelligenz, die dann, wenn das Baby schreit nachts, dann geht es so und geht quasi mit dem Baby mit. Je nachdem, wie das Baby schreit. Und das ist so die Technologie, die ich cool finde, aber ich bin da auch completely biased. Das ist das Unternehmen meiner Frau. Das heißt, das ist quasi so ganz emotional auch, dass ich dann natürlich der Champion von bin. Aber von der Brand-Perspektive her fand ich spannend, wie die innerhalb von wenigen Jahren ein Household-Name geworden sind. Einfach wie sie dann mit dem Marketing auch clever waren und wie sie im Prinzip auch dann jetzt so das cool gemacht haben, quasi Parents zu sein und cool zu sein, dass du dann so ein iconic Bed in deinem Raum hast, wo du im Prinzip das Baby reinpacken kannst und kriegst mehr Schlaf und so. Und deswegen, das ist so meine persönliche Brand, die mich bewegt, ja.
Sehr schön, okay. Auch absolut nachvollziehbar. Muss ich mir selber mal anschauen. Also ich kenne die Thematik logischerweise, aber ich kenne die Marke jetzt nicht direkt. Gibt wahrscheinlich auch schon ein paar Copycats in dem Bereich, ne? Also die das wahrscheinlich auch irgendwie machen. Aber ich gucke es mir auf jeden Fall danach mal an. Letzte Frage und dann gehen wir mitten rein in dein Lieblingsthema vermutlich oder zumindest dein berufliches Thema auch. Wie würdest du dich denn in einem Wort beschreiben, wenn du nur ein einziges Wort hättest?
Das wäre so ein Wort mit einem Bindestrich, also praktischer Philosoph. Also Philosoph wäre ein Wort, aber praktischer Philosoph im Sinne von, ich denke gerne, aber will dann auch gerne was damit machen.
Sehr gut. Ich hätte jetzt gleich reingegangen, aber ich glaube, das ergibt sich vielleicht jetzt auch über das Gespräch. Christian, erzähl mal ganz kurz, wer bist du, was machst du? Jetzt darfst du voll in die Vollen gehen.
Ja, ich hatte ja damals nach diesem Autounfall, das hat mich so sehr auf so eine Sinnsuche gebracht, wo ich mir viele Fragen gestellt habe. Weißt du, wenn du so kurz dem Tod nahe stehst und auf der Klippe stehst, viele Fragen so nach dem Motto, wenn ich gestorben wäre, wer zu meiner Beerdigung gekommen wäre, wen hätte es interessiert und so weiter und so weiter. Und waren ziemlich viele deprimierende Antworten damals und das hat mich dann auf so eine Sinnsuche gebracht. Da habe ein tolles Buch gelesen, Viktor Frankl, die haben dieses Man's Search for Meaning, im Deutschen trotzdem Ja zum Leben sagen, wo es darum geht, wie kannst du in Krisen, in schwierigen Momenten trotzdem noch irgendwie Bedeutung finden, Sinn finden und dann mit was machen. Und was ich für mich festgestellt habe, ist, ich finde eben sehr viel Sinn so in diesem Punkte verknüpfen, dieses Menschen zusammenbringen, Ideen zusammenbringen. Habe so als Community Builder angefangen und Unternehmer, wo wir Innovatoren zusammengebracht haben, die unterstützt haben und so weiter. Und dann bin später in Akademie gegangen und fand es dann eben spannend, dass so die interessantesten Menschen von irgendwie dem Lokalunternehmer irgendwo zu dem CEO von den tollsten Unternehmen hatten was gemeinsam. Und zwar, dass die interessantesten von denen irgendwie diese Serendipität kultiviert haben, dass sie irgendwie richtig gut darin waren, in genau der gleichen Situation, die andere Leute auch haben, ein bisschen mehr Glück zu haben. Und das fand ich unglaublich spannend, so diese Idee, hey, ist da was anderes als so dieses blinde Glück, was einem einfach so widerfährt, was die ganze soziale Ungleichheit und so herstellt, gibt es vielleicht auch dieses andere Glück, dieses aktive Glück, was irgendwie Menschen für sich kreieren. Und das ist so quasi jetzt über die letzten 10, 15 Jahren meine Forschung auch gewesen, so diese Idee, du hast diese ganzen verschiedenen Geschichten von unerwartetem Glück und vor allem eben auch Menschen in Führungspositionen, die weit gekommen sind, die dann sagen, ja, ich hatte das Glück, dass ich die und die Person getroffen hatte oder dass ich das und das Apartment dann und dann gefunden habe. Ja, aber du hast dich darauf gut vorbereitet. Du hast hart gearbeitet, um mehr Glück zu haben. Und das ist halt so das, wo ich eine richtige Faszination jetzt für habe auf der akademischen Seite, aber eben auch so, wie kann man das Unternehmen mit reinbringen und sagen, baut einen Muskel für das Unerwartete, weil die Welt sich so schnell bewegt jetzt, dass das Unerwartete dann weggeht vom, oh, es ist nur was schlimm ist, zu, hey, es ist eigentlich eine Chance, Innovationen zu sehen, aber eben auch, noch Potenzialität zu sehen. Also, dass oftmals wir einen Plan haben, wir denken, es ist das Beste, was draußen gibt, aber wir wissen ja gar nicht, was es alles draußen gibt. Das heißt, wir halten uns fern von allem, was sein könnte, wenn wir uns dem Unerwarteten verschließen. Und das finde ich eben unglaublich spannend.
extrem einleuchtend und direkt spannend. Und natürlich, das wäre eigentlich eine Frage gewesen, die ich dir gestellt hätte, wie bist du eigentlich zu dem Thema gekommen? Und jetzt erfahre ich selber auch gerade, dass es bei dir auch ein persönlicher Schicksalsmoment war, aber auch ganz, ganz spannend. Ich würde vorschlagen, Christian, wir wechseln jetzt mal auch gerne ins Englische, weil man merkt eben, also du bist da tief in einer Research-Sprache sozusagen auch drin. Und ich bin total gespannt, wie du das auch ganz, ganz authentisch, original eben sozusagen unübersetzt dann auch rhetorisch erklärst, weil darauf, wie gesagt, bin ich am gespanntesten. And maybe, Christian, we start with a yeah, like maybe the most basic question. What is serendipity? Can you explain it? Can you define it a little bit?
Yeah. Well, serendipity is this active luck that's based on how we engage the unexpected. So it's, you know, very different from the blind luck, right? Like birth lottery, all the kind of stuff that just happens to you, good luck or bad luck. That feels fair or unfair, like in the moment where you're kind of like, oh, like, yeah, I got here, but actually I didn't really work for it, right? So that's the blind luck that just happens to people. It's an event and, you know, it goes well or it doesn't go well. But then serendipity is the interaction between something unexpected happening and our reaction to it. What do we do with it? So take the example, right? If you have erratic hand movements like I do, you spill a lot of coffee, right? So imagine you accidentally spill a coffee in a coffee shop over the person next to you. That person looks at you really annoyedly, right? She's like, oh my God, why? Like, what happened? But you sense there might be something there. You're just thinking, you know, this seems like an interesting person. You know what? I would love to get to know that person. And now you have a couple of options to react to that unexpected moment, right? One option is you just say, I'm so sorry. Here's a napkin. You walk outside and you think, ah, what could have happened had I spoken with a person? And another option is you start that conversation and that person becomes the love of your life or your co-founder or your next client, you name it. And so the idea is, how do we act on it? And I think especially in the corporate context, that's so often, right, that we see most innovations that are really interesting coming that way. So for example, one of my absolute favorites is the potato washing machine. Potato washing machine is big company in China producing washing machines, refrigerators and so on. And they receive calls from farmers. And the farmers told them, your crappy washing machine is always breaking down. Well, why is it breaking down? Well, we're trying to wash our potatoes in it and it doesn't seem to work. Now, what would we usually do? We'd probably tell them, don't wash your potatoes in the washing machine. No more warranty for you, right? Like, don't do that. Like our plan says that you shouldn't wash your potatoes in it. Now, what did they do? Exactly the opposite. They said, you know what? That's unexpected, but there's probably a lot of farmers in the world who have a similar problem. So why don't we build in a better dirt filter and make it a potato washing machine? And that's how these kind of innovations, right? Everything from Post-it notes, penicillin, Viagra emerges, where people see something unexpected, but instead of seeing it as, oh my God, this doesn't fit into my schema, this doesn't fit into what I'm thinking, they are like, you know what? Maybe that could be even more interesting than what we're working on at the moment.
Oh, okay. I already have dozens of questions regarding that, but I will come to that later. Maybe we stick a little bit to the fundamental idea of serendipity. What does it, I mean, what does it mean? You already answered, but where does it come from? Where did it come from? Is it like a theory? How did it evolve and develop over the years?
Yeah. That's a great question, because it used to be more the kind of anecdotal thing, right, where people used to tell stories. So you would say, oh, I unexpectedly met someone here and then we married. And, you know, you would just talk about it in a more passive way. And what I found fascinating over the last 10 years or so, there's a lot of research now that is more and more around saying, how do we make a more science-based approach to it that understands how you can have experiments, for example, that can look at serendipity and make it more likely, right? So we do a lot of experiments where you can literally manipulate, in the sense that, I mean, manipulate, not in the word of manipulation, but in the word of where you have different groups where you can see that if you have particular strategies that you employ, you have more serendipity happen. Or, for example, we look at business incubator and we're trying to understand, when something unexpected happens like COVID, who does something with it and who doesn't, and what's the difference? And so really kind of trying to understand, why does one choose this and the other choose this? And so we play around with these kind of counterfactuals, right? So what could have happened? And then trying to understand what actually happened. And so I think that the fascinating thing over the last 15 years has been that now you go to the major academic management conference, the Academy of Management Conference, and one of the biggest symposia is on serendipity. And so that's kind of like where now it's not only this kind of hippie topic anymore, where it was like 10, 15 years ago, where it's kind of like, you know, I was told when I started working on it on the academic side, it's kind of like, you know, this is like academic suicide, like don't do it because like that's the kind of thing that you cannot publish. And now is the kind of thing where I think a lot of people might see, you know what, that's actually how life really happens. Like we can pretend that life is all about planning and strategy and things like that, but actually life is more emergent. And I see that especially in conversations with senior leaders, because you know, when you're the CEO of XYZ big company, in the past, you would go into a board meeting and you would say, I had a plan and, you know, I always had that plan and I made it happen, right? So you, in a way, you want to show control. You want to show authority. You don't want to be the loser who didn't have a plan. But now, instead of lying in a way, right, where everyone in the room knows that, no, there were a couple of like unexpected twists and turns here, you can go into a room, you can say, I had a plan. Then I cultivated an environment for serendipity and for new ideas. And now I have an even better plan. And then people are like, yes, great. That's an active approach to leadership. And Tom Lindeberger, the CEO of Cummins, said it beautifully, that cultivating serendipity is an active approach to leadership in times of uncertainty, because it's getting away from the idea that you can know everything to the idea that you can give people priorities, you can give them a North Star, you can give them values, but then also the most interesting things will emerge. And so you got to give them that kind of space for it. And I think that kind of like in a way then legitimizes the emergence of the unexpected, not as a threat to the authority of a leader, but actually to the plan of the leader. And I think that's where you can differentiate old school and new school leadership.
I would come back to that for sure, because this will be like one of my main questions. But before that, because I like what you already did, that you put that development of serendipity a little bit in different phases. And I would be curious about how was the development over the last years? Is it like there were some milestones, for example, of course, Corona, but how was it also before? Can you describe it a little bit, like where there's some major shifts or phases where you can say, okay, this was how it evolved, how it developed, and how the status of this topic was in the past, or in like in the last 30 years, 15 years? You can just describe or choose what kind of frame you choose.
I think I would look at it from two perspectives. One is on the academic side, I think, or on the kind of thought leadership side, I think there's been a clear kind of evolution from some people writing about it because they've experienced it in their own lives. And then you would give a TED talk about it. You would kind of tell your story about it, to essentially now, you know, a special issue in the main strategic management journal, which is the major strategy journal that has a special issue, where now, if you're a young PhD student, you can send a paper to the major strategy journal. And essentially, you can go to your supervisor and say, you know what, the major journal says that this is a good topic to study. And so it's this legitimization, I think, happened in the last few years, where you have that kind of, you know, major symposia, major special issues and things, where in a way, now it's legit to work on it. And I think especially for young people, that's a great thing, because it means the field is really becoming a real field of thought leadership, of research that builds on each other. Rather than just people telling their stories, it's kind of really building on each other and developing it. So I think that's fantastic, because we learn more of the nuance, like what makes serendipity real serendipity, what not, and so on. I think on the other side, you mentioned COVID. I think what I found fascinating is that when I started working on serendipity, I think a lot of it was around like nice to have. So it would be the kind of thing of, great, let's have more innovation or more contacts or more partners, right? So it's something that you add on top of the good things you're doing. With COVID especially, but also more broadly, right? We talked about the wildfires here, all these kind of different things that are happening. I think now it's also much more about, out of necessity, you have to create serendipity because you have so many negative unexpected events, so many crises, where then the choice is, does the crisis define you or you define the crisis? And serendipity is inherently about meaning-making crisis. It's inherently about saying, if something bad happens, can I do something with it? To give an example, right? So the big example is COVID, and, you know, one of the organizations I work with, for example, they do, you know, in-person courses in the Cape Flats in Cape Town, right? Poverty context, where anyways, the whole time they have to, out of necessity, make things happen. But when COVID happened, they had to shut down all of their in-person education programs. And so they realized, you know what, we can use WhatsApp and other similar texting programs to do nano courses where people can text each other course content. And that became one of their major products. And so they were really able to use that, but again, out of necessity. And I think a lot of companies out of necessity, especially also in the global north, had to, you know, become better at building a muscle for the unexpected. But then the second thing I think that's really interesting is when you think about what's actually happening in terms of how people look at the world, I think especially in the last 10, 15 years in terms of anxiety, in terms of like just nothing being in stone anymore, right? Like everything is just like, everything is in question. Like nothing, you know, I came to the US 5 years ago. And since then we've had COVID where everything was just shut down. I couldn't see my parents because I couldn't fly back. I was shut down in my apartment. I couldn't like really leave anything. Then I came to LA, our house burned down in LA. Like it's the kind of thing where like, it's just, I mean, these are extremes, right? I don't think everyone has these kind of extremes, but then with Trump and everything else, like there's so many things where it's just like constant ambiguity and constant kind of like changing things. And so I think the interesting thing is that I think we're also getting to the point where it's a survival strategy to be really good at cultivating serendipity. And I've seen it with myself. To me, the idea of building a muscle for the unexpected, of cultivating serendipity, has been the only thing that has kept me mostly sane, just to kind of like be able to, you know, we talked earlier, like we had a lot of, you know, dramatic incidences over the last couple of years. And I think the only way is, Can you meaning make it then into something that still feels meaningful over time? And there, maybe as last example on the micro level, look at my mother-in-law, right? She's really good at this. She's the kind of person who, you know, she has a car accident in front of the supermarket. And you know how everyone would usually be really like annoyed, right? You would be like, oh my God, like, you know, like give me the information of the guy and like just leave. She's the kind of person who then makes a friend with a person she had a car accident with, and he turns out to be one of the biggest podcast producers, and her husband gets on the show. And so my point is, like, it's those kind of things where then serendipity comes from something where most of us would say, this is a crisis, this was a bad thing. But I think meaning-making it makes it really interesting, because then you look at every crisis and you're like, you know what? Can I still find some meaning in there? And it's not toxic positivity. It's not saying everything is great. No, everything is not great. Life is painful. Life is hard. But can I still find some meaning in that moment so that I look back and say, I did something with that moment?
That's another great, great angle and topic for later. Like, isn't it like only positivity and also a little bit like, yeah, you always tend to make everything good, even if it's not a good thing. But I will put that later and ask that later. First of all, my main question, I already asked you that before, is like, as you described, we are living in the like most uncertain time, at least it feels like that, and you see that all the different happenings are coming together. We can see the sparks are a little bit higher in the World Uncertainty Index and so on. You know that better than I do, but the big question is, because I think that most of the leaders out there, especially in KMUs, for example, so where you think a little bit pragmatic maybe, I can imagine that the leaders there say, okay, I'm not stupid. I'm not looking for serendipity and for coincidences and for happenings and then looking on the bright side in the most uncertain time of our lives and of our companies. For my main question is, isn't it like a little bit counterintuitive that you say, when everything is uncertain, aren't you going to control everything even more instead of looking and waiting for serendipity?
Mm-hmm. And that's exactly so I think that's, you put the nail on the head, that I think that illusion of control, right? That idea that you can control things in a world where you have so many variables that it's impossible to control them, you set yourself up for failure, right? Because you're essentially saying, I'm trying to control and micromanage and do things where by definition, you can't understand the whole complexity of it. So by definition, something will emerge. And so what I find fascinating is to say, let's get away from the dichotomy between planning, either planning or coincidence. And let's say, let's plan for the unexpected. Let's say, especially, you know, look, we grew up in Germany, right? So it's kind of like, yeah, we're really good at planning. So by any means, let's plan as much as we can. Let's build the best processes we can do. Let's do this and this and this and this. But then let's build in the awareness that the unexpected will most likely change something in this. 5 years ago, if you would go to a Mittelständler 5 years ago and say, well, you know, künstliche Intelligenz will completely, within the next 15 years, like completely make you rethink everything you're doing at some point, right? Even if you might need a couple of years to get there, like you will at some point completely rethink most of the things you're doing, they would, you know, most people would say, ah, nah, that's crazy. Like we know exactly what we're doing and our process is the best and we're incrementally improving. And you're like, you know what? That is true. there's the incremental improvement. And then there's from time to time these kind of like things that come in where you're like, you know what, that's just something you can't see coming. And I'm always a big fan of this. You know, the Economist magazine, they have this thing in the end sometimes at the end of the year or so where they predict things. And most of the predictions are wrong. Why? Because by definition, the world is too complex to understand and to predict. And so I guess what I'm trying to say is I work a lot with kind of, you know, small and medium-sized companies. And where we always arrive at is to say, look, you get a lot of your authority as a leader from the idea that you can say where you want to go to, right? That you can that the Schiff, wie sagt man, das Segel, you can steer the ship, right? Yes, of course, keep that authority by any means. Plan as much as you can, but at the same time, you have to build in the unexpected. And so, to give an example. Ajay Banga, when he was the CEO of MasterCard, he was really good at this. He would say, well, you know what? We have certain like ideas of where we want to go. I want to bring 400, 500 million people who were previously unbanked, so who didn't have access to capital. I want to bring them into the financial system. That's my big goal that I want to do in the next few years. Here is the strategy and priorities. You know, we will start here, then we will go this and this and this and this. But I'm telling you already now that if Hilda in Cape Town tells us that this strategy doesn't work with her, we will adjust the strategy, and that is part of our plan. And by doing that, he's legitimizing the idea that you can have local solutions that are even better than that. And I've always been fascinated by this because look at COVID, right? You might have seen in the US and other countries where if you have a decentralized system, old school leadership is you're saying COVID happens, we're shutting down everything, but we're opening exactly to this timeline. This is the exact timeline that we open up again. When you do that, you set yourself up for failure because you don't know yet how the virus will develop. You don't know yet when you will have vaccines that will actually allow you to open up and so on. And so when you want to be this control freak that says, I know everything and I can do everything, people will not take you seriously at some point because you either have to lie to them and hold back data, which some people do, right? They just pretend that everything is fine and then they open up anyways, but you're kind of like, yeah, you know what? Like maybe it isn't like you thought. Or they look a bit more vulnerable, right? Because it wasn't what they promised. Versus new school leadership is to say, here's our priorities. Societal health, economic health, here's our timeline that we're giving you. This is the best estimate we can give you at this point. But I'm telling you already now that once we learn more about the virus, we will most likely adjust the timeline, and that is part of our plan. And so what you're trying to do here is you're trying to give people as much certainty as possible, but you're also not trying to pretend that you know it all. And I think that to me then is real leadership, because you're essentially building trust by saying, I want to give you as much certainty as I can, but I also have to make you understand, as a leader, that's my responsibility, to make you understand that we cannot control all variables. And that's okay, because again, we'll figure out a way. And I think giving that kind of trust, that's where real leadership comes from, versus pretending that you know it all. And then, you know, there's a lot of work around control illusion, where people who set themselves up for failure, it's exactly the people who think they can map everything out. And then they realize after a couple of years, oh my goodness, like I put myself on a path dependency that didn't work because I had to hide things now or I had to do things. And so it's safer in a way. Paradoxically so, it's both safer and more successful to plan for the unexpected.
Yes, totally. I can relate with that. But now I would like to get back to a question, also to a quote that you just made today a couple of times. You talked about building up a muscle, like understanding serendipity as something like a muscle that you can train. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What does it mean to develop or train this muscle?
Well, so fundamentally, when you look at serendipity as a process, right? So the beautiful thing is that you can influence it. So serendipity is really this process, right? If you take the example of the coffee shop that I mentioned, there is something unexpected happening. So that's the trigger, right? That's by definition, it's random, it's unexpected. We don't know when it happens, how it happens. That happens. And then there's the moment of meaning making, the moment of connecting the dots, of doing something with it. And then there's the moment of actually, you know, going forward and putting it into a product or something else. So you have those three steps of the initial kind of trigger, then somehow connecting some dots, and then actually actioning on it or making a product out of it or something like that. The beautiful thing is now you can, at each process step, you can do something. So for example, you can create more serendipity triggers, right? So let me give you an example. you know, one of my favorite strategies is the hook strategy, where the idea is that, you know, you give a couple of more information points so that you make it more likely that some unexpected overlap can happen. So if you ask me, Christian, you know, if I meet you at a conference and you ask me, Christian, what do you do? I would tell you something like, you know what? I'm researching serendipity, but what I'm really excited about at the moment is parenting because I just had a four-year-old and, you know, you can see the lines under my eyes or something like that. Where you could be like, oh my God, such a coincidence. I also have a four-year-old. Let's talk, right? And the fascinating thing with this strategy is that a lot of times actually, paradoxically so, right? Like when you're, especially when you're in a client business, like the intuition always is, let me sell, right? Let me give people a pitch. But actually, counterintuitively, the real way how you get a great client is to do exactly the opposite. Pitch is like, let me tell you about everything that's great here. A hook is to say, let me give you a couple of things that you can pick from, and then you choose the thing that you like the best because my priority is to build a meaningful relationship with you, and then I can talk with you about anything else. So to give you an example, I had a workshop recently with game developers. And you can imagine game developers, you know, they're not the most outgoing of people, and you know, and so we did a workshop on that hook strategy. And we said, okay, next time you go to a conference, use it and then let me know how it worked. I get an email a couple of days later after the conference from one of them that says, look, I met this guy and he asked me, so what do you do? And I said, well, I'm developing this and this game. But what I'm really excited about is, what is it, metaverse and what is it, black holes. And so this other guy is like, oh my God, finally someone who also loves black holes, let's talk about it. And so for an hour, they nerd out about black holes. And then after an hour, the other guy says, you know what? I really like you. How can I help you? And turns out he's an investor who can actually help him with his kind of company. And so the point here is, if he had pitched to him, like, I have this great company, he would have been one of the hundreds of entrepreneurs who pitched to that guy. But if he's the only person who actually talked about the thing that the guy really wanted to talk about, or at least something that they really interested in, that obviously builds the real relationship that you could build. So first, I think it's the kind of thing in those kind of where you meet people for the first time, but also in the day-to-day, right? If you're a brain trust, right? Like if you're an introvert like me, like I'm one of these hidden introverts, right? No problem speaking in front of people, but then I need an hour in the hotel to kind of recharge my batteries. And so when you're like someone like me, your nightmare is that you bump into a colleague in the morning when you're tired and they ask you, how are you doing? And you're kind of like, oh my God, like now I have to make conversation for 2 minutes as we walk up the stairs. And so one thing that I found extremely helpful is to just throw in a couple of hooks, like to literally have a couple of hooks that are meaningful to me at the moment that I'm just throwing in. Like, hey, Christian, how are you doing? Oh my God, yeah, you know, my four-year-old, she really keeps me up at night. Or, oh my God, like just something I can throw in. And the amazing thing is, so again, that's just, especially for introverts, helpful, but it also can really help you in your career. I talked with a board member recently of a huge, huge, huge international company. And she told me how she got her job at that kind of high level. And she was like, look, like I bumped into the CEO in the office and he asked me, so what are you working on? And I said, I'm working on this, but I'd also be really curious to learn more and work more on this. And he's like, you know what? I didn't even know you're interested in this. We actually are looking for people who can make that bridge. Like, let me put you into that board position. And so that's how she like literally got like one of the most pronounced board positions. And so the point is, I think there's a lot in there to say people can only help you if they know what you're looking for. But also more importantly, you can only really connect the dots when you know. What to connect the dots to and give people the opportunity to see that. And then you will realize, and I think that to me also is a big answer to all these partisanship things and like we're all so different. No, we're not. We're just different if we identify ourselves as like these kind of Schubladen, like I'm, you know, Christian, I'm a professor and you're like Peter and you're a fisherman. Okay, then we're very different. But hey, I'm Christian and I just survived like a wildfire and you're Peter who are a fisherman and you just also survived a wildfire. We have a lot to talk about in terms of like trauma, in terms of like things like that. And so once we understand that we all have a lot in common, we just need to bring it out through how we put hooks, how we ask questions, right? Instead of asking, what do you do? Asking, what do you enjoy doing? Right? Things like that, where you just open the opportunity space and then, you know, serendipity starts to happen everywhere. And so there's a lot of those kind of practices that you can use to make serendipity more likely to happen.
I mean, that's a great example and a great methodology to, like you said, to train this muscle and also to get more trigger points. And you did that with me right at the beginning where I asked you, how are you feeling today? And I mean, it's 9 o'clock in the morning for you, so it's a little bit harder for you the question than for me. But instantly, the second thing or second topic that you started was actually, okay, why are you feeling like that? What is moving you at the moment and so on? So you did that exactly what you just described. So a very nice activity and a very nice example or method to do that. But maybe let's get even more practical, as you described yourself as a practical philosopher. And how do you, I mean, if you trained this muscle, how do you implement it then, especially in a work and corporate environment? Like, what are the processes or the methodologies behind that?
I mean, there's a lot of practices and processes. Two that I find very useful and very hands-on. One is asking people in the weekly meeting, what surprised you last week? It's a very simple question, but when you ask that question, you're doing two things. One is you put people's attention on things they don't expect rather than on what they expect, right? So let's say you develop a brand strategy for a company and you're like, oh, great, like the client seems really happy. And that's kind of like the premise that you come from. So you have a confirmation bias now, right? You want to see every meeting from the perspective of, oh, yeah, they'll love it. But actually, maybe in that one meeting, you saw that person on the very left sitting and like having that weird expression in their face and you felt weird about it, but you didn't know and you just forgot about it. But you know what? Maybe you should have looked at it because that was the founder's son, and the founder's son is the one who's now getting the business, and he actually doesn't want to do it anymore, right? So that kind of thing, where if you put people into like weak cues, so small things that they perceive, and you make them look more for it, they will see much more the kind of nuances that then, for example, make a client sign something or not, that make something go right or wrong, right? And so I think there's a lot in terms of like people looking more for unexpected cues. But also then I think it's a lot about like legitimizing the unexpected and really saying, you know what, we're making this plan now, but I need you to know that just because we did this in this campaign and this is kind of like what we're planning to do, if you figure out that the client actually doesn't sit well with it, I want you to bring that up, and I want us to then work on this. And so I think it's also an early detection of potential failure. And so there's a lot in there. That's one. I think on the individual level, I'm a big fan of learning how to connect the dots, because it's something, I mean, Colin, I've seen you, right? You do it naturally a lot, I think, like connecting dots and like people and things. A lot of people don't naturally have that much of it. And I think I've been working a lot with people where I literally tell them, the next 10 meetings you go into, think about one introduction you can make for the person that's helpful. Think about one idea you can bring in. So instead of just being like the devil's advocate and like, you know, questioning like why this is a good idea, also go in and say, I want to bring in at least one thing that's valuable to that person that I can directly do after the meeting. And when you put people into that, they get into this, you know, you start seeing connections everywhere, because you're like, yeah, of course, last week I talked with a climate scientist. This week, this guy's working on a campaign for like sustainability. I should put them together. Like that's kind of thing, right? So you start connecting the dots much more. And so there's a lot of kind of things around neuroplasticity, right? This idea that the brain is kind of like elastic and you can influence it and you can work on this both as an individual, but also as a team. And so I'm very excited about this. One last thing I wanted to say about the hook strategy, by the way, you know, you talked earlier about how I feel, you know, a lot of my work is in English. But then the book, you know, that you and your team got is in German, right? So I found it fascinating actually to do the, so I wrote the book in English and then we translated it into German. And so I found it fascinating to think through what is different in German, right? So for example, in the American book is called The Serendipity Mindset, The Art and Science of Creating Good Luck, right? And then the British version, Connect the Dots, and the German version, Erfolgsfaktor Zufall. So it's much more focused on like Erfolgsfaktor and so on. So, but when you think about those strategies that I just mentioned, a lot of them are contextually nuanced, right? So when I did the book tour, right, in the US, if I'm in New York, people put directly 10 hooks at my book event, right? They're like, yeah, I'm Peter and I'm doing this and this and this and this and this and this. When I'm in Hamburg at a book event, people put like 1.5 hooks, right? So it's kind of like, so it depends, of course, on the context, how much you put out there, depends on what feels authentic. So I think that's kind of like one of the things also to just keep in mind that, like, you know, sometimes like these kind of strategies, I think you can adjust to the context. And I think that's the fascinating thing of it, that again, as Germans, we might be more risk averse than an American, but at the same time, the concept itself still is applicable, just to a different degree. And so I think there's a lot of nuance around this culturally as well.
Cool. Maybe just to make this topic and also the segment of our talk here like a final, if you need to boil it down to like one sentence, how do you, or what does serendipity for our organization mean when it comes to implementation? Like, is it about cultivating it? Is it like a systematic approach? How would you explain it really to, okay, if you want to go for serendipity in a corporate environment, you have to do that and that. Can you boil it down to like one sentence?
Make the unexpected your friend. Like, instead of seeing the unexpected as something that's interrupting your plans, that's kind of something that's bad, see it as like an information point. See it as something where the most exciting things, like when you think back in your own lives, right? Like, yes, you might have had a crush on that person and you worked for 2 years to get together with that person, but then randomly you met that other person in the bar and you're like, geez, that's the real person I was looking for, right? And so the point is, like, a lot of times, you know, the unexpected brings the even better things, but we're a lot of times blind to it. Because we see it just as a threat. And so I think the more we legitimize this, the more we prime people towards seeing information points in the unexpected as signals that in the first place don't have any meaning, right? So to give an example, let's say your boyfriend, girlfriend unexpectedly breaks up with you, right? That's a very negative, unexpected event in the moment. But then 5 months later, you meet the real love of your life, right? Now the you're saying, thank you very much, person 5 months ago, that you broke up with me, because you know, like, I wouldn't have found that person. The same is with a good strategy. If you kind of have a strategy, right, that really sucks, and you push it and push it and push it, and you don't see those kind of like, oh, this one client actually who has been with us for 5 years, for some reason they didn't call us this week, or they don't call us anymore. If you just see that as kind of like, whatever, then you might miss this kind of early warning point, but also the opportunity to say, maybe for all clients, we should improve our service offering. And then you might look back in a few years and say, thank you very much, one client who we lost, but we understood the signal so that we could actually use that to make a much better product. And I've seen that in my own life as an entrepreneur. Some of the things that almost make us bankrupt, for example, were the things that finally forced us to have a much better product, a much better plan and strategy. And so I've learned that a lot of times the unexpected presents itself as a negative thing, but then it's up to our meaning making what we do with it. And that's kind of like, to me, the responsibility of leadership, to say, let's meaning make the unexpected. When COVID happens and I'm a brewery, you can say, oh no, our business is gone. Or you can say, you know what, we have a lot of alcohol here, so why don't we produce hand sanitizer and become a leading hand sanitizer company, right? And so that's kind of the spirit, to say, can I see something, the unexpected, that maybe others don't see?
I have to think about a little bit what is the next question, because I wrote down a lot of questions right at the beginning. Then maybe right at the beginning, you talked about the word of luck, Glück, and you said, and also Barack Obama, I think he described it also on the German version of your book, that he's quoted there, and he's describing also like what luck means, and that luck is not just luck. It comes to the person who like prepared a little bit for that. I mean, you can say that in better words, but still, as when you started about talking about luck, I thought about how do you prepare for luck? Like, how do you manage that somehow? Because you said a little bit, or at least it applied, that you can not control, but you can prepare for that. I mean, I think you know where I'm trying to go there. Like, how can you prepare for luck? How can you look out for good luck and not for bad luck, for example?
Yeah, it's a great question, because it's so much about framing, right? And so much about, I want to tell you briefly about one of my favorite experiments that shows you the importance of framing, because there's experiments that literally show that people who consider themselves to be lucky tend to be luckier in the future, not because of some kind of abracadabra, it falls from the sky, but because of how they look at life and because of the kind of mindset. And so in this one experiment, they pick people who consider themselves as very lucky and people who consider themselves to be very unlucky. So bad luck always happens to me, I'm always in accidents and so on. And we probably all know people on this continuum, right? Between very lucky and very unlucky. And so they pick one of each and they say, walk down the street, go into a coffee shop, sit down, and then we'll have our conversation. What they don't tell them is that there's hidden cameras alongside the street and inside the coffee shop. There's a £5 note, so money, right in front of the coffee shop door. And inside the coffee shop, there's this amazing, successful business person, and one seat is free next to him. Now, the lucky person walks down the street, sees the £5 note, picks it up, goes inside the shop, sits next to the business person, they have a conversation, they exchange business cards, and potentially an opportunity comes out of it. The unlucky person walks down the street, steps over the £5 note, doesn't see it, goes inside the shop, sits next to the business person, ignores the business person, that's it. At the end of the day, they ask both people, how was your day today? And so the lucky person says, well, it was amazing. I found money in the street, made a new friend, and, you know, potentially a new opportunity coming out of it. The unlucky person just says, nah, nothing really happened. And, you know, you see that a lot with couples who go to exactly the same event. One comes back and says, oh my God, this was so boring. And like, this person really bored me. The other person comes back and says, oh my God, I made my new best friend, or, you know, this amazing person I met. It's a lot of times a reflection of ourselves. And the reason I'm highlighting this so much is because in the moment, it seems like luck. But to give an example, I had a friend, he told me recently, I didn't even realize, when he was a student, when people still used cash, right? Like now credit card probably makes that less and less so. But when he was a student, he knew that people would get so drunk at the bar that they would always, like money would always fall down. So he would literally sit at the bar and just wait for whenever like money dropped. I'm not endorsing it ethically, right? I'm not saying this is the right thing to do. I'm just saying he positioned himself for unexpected money drops, if that makes sense. And so my point here is that there's two incidences here, right? Where luck was engineered. One is like the money on the street. And that's a lot about, do you, like your perception, like do you look at the world and do you try to see cues? Do you try to like go with the world with open eyes? Like you go through the street, you maybe see a book in the bookstore and you're like, you know what? I could make a marketing campaign that's related to the content of that book, right? So that's kind of like in a way, the open eyes, the open-mindedness, keeping the eyes open that kind of prepares you for having that more and more. But then also I think the second aspect, the kind of, you know, speaking with the businessman, that's a great thing, right? I think the hook strategy and things can really help. But importantly, I think a lot of times, you know, for a closet introvert like myself, serendipity comes from quiet sources. It doesn't have to be the business person. It can be the kind of watching a movie and thinking, oh my God, I could make a campaign that builds in that idea, right? And so I think that the key behind serendipity is this idea of, can I prepare myself and can I have the awareness that everywhere there could be something. And I think that kind of like when I work with people, my very first step is an awareness of serendipity, because an awareness of serendipity already makes it more likely that you start seeing it. To give an example in a corporate context, there was a company that essentially told their executives, in the next couple of weeks, look out for unexpected things. They started to look out for them and they had more interesting marketing ideas just because they were aware of it. And so I think it's those kind of things where you once you put yourself, your mind to it, but then also put a couple of practices, then you can influence it. But the most important thing, and I really want to highlight that, so it's both, right, the mindset, and then it's the practices and the hooks and things like that. And you know, if that's interesting for you, we have a serendipity playbook that's freely available on the internet. You can see all the practices in there. But like there's a lot of practice you can do. But also then the most important thing, I think, is the underlying psychological self-limiting beliefs, right? So imagine the situation where you are in that coffee shop and you think that person is interesting, but you don't speak with her or him. And then you walk outside and you think, ah, what could have happened? Or you're in the meeting, you have this unexpected great idea, but you don't bring it in because you don't feel ready, worthy, you name it. And then you walk outside and you think, ah, what could have happened? And so the fascinating thing there is, right, that a lot of times our brains go to what's the worst case if I do it, right? So the worst case of doing it is the sting of rejection, right? But what you realize, what I've realized for myself, who certainly has had a fear of rejection, is that the worst thing is not the rejection. The worst thing is the regret of not doing it and then walking around for a week and thinking, ah, what could have happened? And so I think that reframing away from what's the worst thing that can happen if I do it to what's the worst thing if I don't do it? And then you realize it's actually much less risky to act, because not acting actually is the higher risk of, you know, regret and all these different things.
Great. Another very great quote and learning out of the talk here. Another thing that was stuck a little bit in my mind also after our initial talk before that podcast today was, isn't it like a little bit even cynical if you look on real bad things like the wildfires, for example, and you lost your house and you're affected by these things. But isn't it then cynical then thinking, okay, yeah, I just had a crisis, I lost someone, something, whatever happened to me, real bad things. And then I stand there and say, hey, what could be the positive out of that? I mean, it's not like that. I'm not saying that you're describing it like that, but still, I think this could be a skeptic question, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think that's where I think the difference comes in between, you know, on TikTok, for example, they had this lucky girl syndrome where it's like, just imagine that you'll be successful and you'll be successful. No, like that sets you up for disappointment. If you're sitting on the couch and you think about like, oh, I'll be this great person, not going to happen, right? It's just not going to happen. And also life is much more difficult than that. And so I think there's a big difference between this toxic positivity that potentially emerges when you think things just happen when you put them out there. And actually the rational optimism that Viktor Frankl talks about, which is all about saying, you know, so Viktor Frankl was in a concentration camp, right? The toughest environment you can imagine. He was stuck in there. And he said, you know what? I'm stuck in the toughest of environments here, but I need to keep hope. I need to make sure that I don't, you know, become suicidal or that I don't lose the hope where then physiologically also your body just kind of very quickly disintegrates, right? So the point is he tried to figure out what is a way to survive in an environment like this, where a lot of times you obviously don't have a choice. But the one choice he felt he had was to say, I can try to psychologically stay as resilient as I can. And so what he did was he did two things essentially. One was he said, I still want to do something when I get out of here. So I still want to write that book. And so I have a big meaning here. But also, you know what? I will speak with other prisoners every day to make them feel better. And now I have a reason every day to wake up, because every day I can still make someone feel better. And I applied that approach to a couple of my students. You know, when COVID happened, I was teaching in New York you know, the university there, everything was kind of shut down. I don't know if you remember New York. It was the craziest period I've ever experienced before the wildfires. Now the wildfires have been the craziest, but COVID in New York, you have to imagine outside my house. At that point, I was single. Outside my house, I had a Coca-Cola truck with dead bodies because they didn't have enough space for dead bodies. In Central Park, I lived right next to Central Park. They had hospital tents because the hospitals were too full, so they couldn't take people in. They had a military ship in front of the harbor because they didn't have enough space for people. It was complete mayhem. It felt like everything was just going to hand. And at that point, I had students asking me, right, who just started, and they came from India, China, Germany, you name it, like everywhere around the world. And from one day to the other, they're stuck in their apartment. They can't meet each other. They're social distancing, so they're not allowed to meet other people. So they're completely alone. They don't have like people around them, right? And so the thing I did with a couple of them was to say, you know what? Think about a micro meaning. Think about something that we can do that you have a reason to wake up tomorrow morning, because I know that your studies will not be it. Your studies will feel so abstract to you now. That yes, we will make it as practical as possible and it's going to be great, but we have to find something. So if you have an elderly neighbor, for example, ask them, can I get on the app for you? And can I order you every morning your food? Because I know that you can't use the app and I know you can't go to the supermarket because, you know, you will infect yourself. And obviously at your age, that doesn't work. Like those kind of things where now you have a meaning to wake up tomorrow morning because you have a responsibility. And I've seen that in other contexts where especially people who, you know, don't necessarily have a strong meaning at the moment, when you give them micro meanings in the day-to-day job, in the day-to-day, whatever they do, then they feel again, oh, I can go through a tough crisis. And so I've seen that right with the wildfires. You mentioned that. So the context is right. Our house burned down. We lived in the Pacific Palisades. So our house burned down, as well as the house of my parents-in-law, like our whole community just burned down. And so you have a situation where something that you would never have thought would happen, because this is, it's the kind of setting that, you know, like you just don't think it can happen that like from one day to the other, all of your neighbors' houses are just gone. And in that moment, then you're like, okay, what is it that you can do? Because I'm a big believer, right, of this Viktor Frankl thing of like, I can't choose the situation anymore. That situation has happened. And I think developing the acceptance for it, that's what psychologists are really good for. That's what meditation is good for, right? Like the kind of, in a way, you're not trying to do the toxic positivity thing where you're saying, no, everything is great. No, everything is not great. It's really bad at the moment. So you're trying to develop that acceptance. But at the same time, you're also saying, what is it still that I can do in this moment? Is there something I can still do now to create meaning? And so to give you like an example here, I try to create a micro meaning and a macro meaning similar to the Frankl idea, where the micro meaning to me was, in the hotel now where we're staying. So we had to evacuate into a hotel, for example. Like, are there people I can connect with who are like similar, like a community? We had some serendipity happen with people we didn't even know that we had similar interests. Things like that, where there was micro serendipity, where it felt, oh, at least there's like life still goes on. And then there's also the macro, where I was like, you know what? Actually, I think I want to write a book about this. I want to write a book about that Zemblanity, the opposite of serendipity. This idea that, you know, Zemblanity is bad luck by design. It's essentially when you have a system like, you know, the system we had, where there's so much fragility in it, so many variables that are so fragile that something like this can happen. And it's unexpected in the moment, but when you look back to it, you're like, wow, there were a lot of red flags here that could have told me that something like this might happen. That then actually, once you realize that most systems are set up that way, in such a fragile way, but also most mindsets and most corporate cultures, that then actually you can find ways to break out of those. And so I'm seeing that with us now. We're in a system at the moment where everyone has been trying to just, you know, mess with you, right? You kind of like, you lose your house, then you try to find a house for rent, but they hike the rents because they know you're desperate, because you have a family, then all these different things, insurance does their thing. Like, so everyone is just, it's just traps everywhere. And so the point then is the question, how do you break out of it? And so I'm kind of like, now for me, the macro meaning is, I want to write a book about how do you break out of those cycles of bad luck. And then hopefully, you know, look back in 15 years and say, yes, this was the worst event in my life, especially with two young kids. We talked about it. We had a newborn. My wife was literally like, she just came out of the hospital with a newborn and we had to evacuate. And that's kind of like the worst incidents I can imagine. But then at the same time saying, you know what, when we look back in 15 years, is there at least something that still emerged from this? And so that's kind of like, in a way, to me, that has been my best psychologist to say, I want to talk it through, but I want to talk it through via writing and via sense making it in a constructive way rather than in a past looking way.
I can give you an example on what happened to me right after the birth of our daughter, but I will do it later on when we are finished with the recording. It's not like your story. It's not comparable, but anyhow, it's some kind of interesting maybe. Let's talk, and maybe some last questions, I would say, because we obviously have to come to an end. Unfortunately, we have to come to an end. I just wrote down at the beginning the word privilege, because you said good luck, bad luck, and so on. And I work for many people who don't have any privileges. So they live in poverty, they live in very crazy and difficult environments. And it sounds like, yeah, good luck. And also like you described a little bit at the beginning, yeah, good luck, you can manage that, you can prepare and so on. But right when you said that, I thought about, okay, isn't it like that the environment for good luck could also be something like a privilege, because you have more like connections, you have maybe you're more open for that because you were born raised like that and so on. So is serendipity kind of a privilege for some people?
It's interesting. So a lot of my work is in context of extreme poverty. So that's where my research started. It started in, you know, the Cape Towns of Cape Town and kind of crime-ridden local communities where you have, you know, unemployment and no access to education or little access to education and so on, in parts of Kenya, in Nairobi, parts of Nairobi. And what I found fascinating is that I actually learned the most about serendipity from those contexts, because people out of necessity have to a lot of times connect the dots. What's different, and where you're absolutely right, and the way we've been trying to, on a nerdy side, right? So we actually did a paper on that, where it's essentially saying what we've been talking a lot about is the agency gradient. So we're talking a lot about the agency you have as an individual, your mindset, right? So that's one dimension. But the other dimension is the structural enablers. It's the kind of conditions that make it more likely that something like serendipity happens, right? So if I'm here in Los Angeles, I can bump into the CEO of XYZ company on the street and something amazing can happen. That doesn't happen when you're in the Cape Flats in Cape Town. You don't bump into that person, right? Or with the kind of access to education, like, it's very different, the kind of level. And so the way I've been thinking about that dimension is like the base level of potential serendipity is different. But within that base level, you will see variation. And so yes, like, you know, if you're in a more abundant, we're talking about abundant serendipity, is like you're in a setting like a top incubator in the US, right? That's an abundant serendipity setting where like usually surprises are positively nuanced, right? Like, oh yeah, like I serendipitously met an investor. And in poverty context, it's usually negatively balanced, right? Because balanced, like it's usually negative to have a surprise because it's usually someone died or someone robbed you or just something that's kind of negative. And so the unexpected tends to be mostly completely negative. And so what I find fascinating is that the base level is very different and the mechanisms are different. So I don't want to bore you with the details of that paper, but essentially what we said in that paper is to say, you know what? The mechanisms in the West are more about bring people together, meaning make together, things like that, the things we talked about. And in abject poverty, especially in crime-ridden communities, it's much more about how do we positively balance people and events. So how do we, for example, I love that example of that R-Labs, which is the organization I work with. What they do, for example, is when you, for the first time, come into their office, you get a fresh coffee, like a freshly brewed cappuccino. They don't have a lot of budget, but you get a freshly brewed cappuccino because for the people in the neighborhood, it's the first time in their life that they get a freshly brewed cappuccino. And it's essentially saying, when you come in here, you leave your gun outside because you come in here because we respect you because you want education, not because you have a gun. And so what you're doing here is now when people come inside, instead of thinking about, is that a threat? Is that a person who could have a gun? You're thinking, oh, that could be a cool person. Like, let me connect with that person. And so what you're doing is you're reframing the unexpected, you're positively balancing it in a completely different way than you would here, because it's about existential threat usually rather than a bit of nice to have and like a bit of like unexpectedness that might be bad, but it's kind of like not necessarily always changing your life. And so I think that, long story short, there's a lot of different mechanisms that we're seeing, but I think you're absolutely right that, so yes, privilege has a lot to say about it and there's a lot in there. But also within almost every context I've studied, unless you have power structures that don't allow it, there's always a little bit variation. But I think our responsibility when you're more privileged is to help create those opportunity spaces that lift the base level of serendipity. I think that's where it gets exciting, right? So for example, instead of just giving someone from a less privileged background a scholarship to go to university, but then again reenact that lack of privilege at the next level, right? Where everyone else is well connected to get a job, but they aren't, like then give them a scholarship, but also give them free mentors who will directly help them afterwards. Stuff like that, where you're like, you're building an opportunity space rather than just like a one-off solution. And so I think that's kind of like more about the systems thinking behind it.
I got it. I can relate with that. I can understand it. It's very interesting because I also think about, like, when you say the mechanism is a little bit the same, like just the environment or the conditions are different. And that you have to really make the frame, the context aware for you, then you can also transfer that to a company. That means if you think about a serendipity as a company or in your company, you also have to reflect what are the conditions, what are the circumstances, and how can I implement this topic very specifically to my culture. So this is what I also learned from that explanation. Let's try to reduce it to the last question, or I try to do it. And another like management question is, Christian, what do I get out of it if I do serendipity? Like is there, what is the effect? What are the business consequences and so on? I assume that you also have to explain that or legitimate that also to some of the leaders. Like, is there a real effect? Is there an advantage?
And actually, so the beautiful thing is that now there's more and more actual, like, harder data on it in terms of, you know, we just finished a study, for example, with one of the largest organizations in the world, where we're showing that the more, like, the higher your serendipity quotient, so the more likely you are to create serendipity, the more likely it is that you will have innovation performance, the more likely it is that you will have more partnerships. So you can relate it to these outcome variables in a way where you can show that a propensity towards serendipity is actually something that will bring you firm outputs or outcomes that are valuable. And so I'm very excited about this because it's the kind of thing where intuitively we've known it for quite some time, but I think you see now more and more work where you can actually see the direct effect on innovation performance, but also on, you know, career success, like stuff like that, where I think we see more and more those kind of studies. So absolutely. But I think also I wanted to mention one more thing about the culture aspect that you mentioned, because to me, that's a very big one. Because, you know, what I used to do when I did more consulting still was I would sit with companies and, you know, before I would have a meeting with them, I would sit at the place wherever people hang out, the canteen, the cafeteria, the lunch, whatever. And I would just listen to people's conversations. I would just sit there and listen how they talk about each other, right? So, you know, you might have a setting where people say, oh, I just came out of this meeting and, you know, Peter, he again, like he did this boring spiel about this and like, we don't believe anyways that he's the right guy and da, 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 right? Really bad corporate culture, right? Versus like another one where it's like, oh, Peter, you know, like he shared this idea and I was thinking we could also do that in Warsaw and then we should also do it here. And like, and so it's kind of like it's an enabling culture. And so I think the culture setting and setting the right framework for people actually having the motivation to connect the dots, I think that's absolutely crucial. Because again, a lot of times people actually don't necessarily want to have serendipity in the company context because they're like, you know what, I actually don't care. And so we did a study where we literally showed that if you, for example, force people to go back to the office and you force them too much and you justify it with, yeah, people have to connect more and they have to innovate more and be more serendipitous and stuff, it can actually have the opposite effect if you're making people feel that it's forced versus that it's actually having a meaning, right? So yeah, you're going in twice a week, but we're going in because it's a meaningful encounter. It's a meaningful meeting we have versus like, we're just telling you to go so that we can tell our bosses that we put you in the office, right? And so I think there's a lot around this idea that a good corporate culture is a setting where you actually have people who want to connect the dots for each other. And if you don't have that setting, they might connect it for themselves. They might do it in their own lives and for their own benefit, but you might not have it for the benefit of the company.
Great. I have three questions left. What is the major reason for not going or incorporating serendipity in your environment, especially in a corporate environment? What is the major reason?
I love that question. I would say two are there. I think if you're not doing it right, I think a lot of companies make the mistake that they just think serendipity is all about bringing people more together. And I think that's the worst thing you can do because that just annoys people. It burns people out. Like if you just kind of do more connections between people, like, cause that's, everyone's like, I really don't want to meet all these people. And like, why would you put me in this? So don't do it if it's just kind of like a tactical move of like doing a little bit of it and leaving it. I think it has to be embedded more in like overall culture. Like, so for example, right? If you're a company that says our culture is playfulness, or innovation, fantastic. Then like it makes sense that you have a weekly meeting where you ask what surprised you last week because you can directly relate to your value. If you have a company where you have that value but it's not practiced, then you have a meeting with what surprised you last week and nobody takes it seriously. Everyone's making just stuff up or like just kind of like, you know, and so it really depends on, I think, connecting it with, you know, how does it fit to our culture? Does it fit to our values? Whatever that is. So first thing, I think the second thing also is more around, do you have good filters? Like, I think, again, like if you, you know, people like myself, for example, I have to be really disciplined to have good filters to not let serendipity distract me, right? Because I have serendipity all the time. Everywhere I go, I have serendipity. But I'm like, you know what is my focus at the moment? What is my priorities? And unless this unexpected thing is so much better than what I'm working on, I'm like, you know what? This is nice, but let me put it as a parking lot here and put it there. And so I think it all depends, again, on like introducing it within the space of, if you are meaning making, what do you connect the dots to? Like what do we want out of this? In the sense of not in a transactional sense, but more in the sense of we would love you to have more serendipity because in the next 5 years we want to become the most amazing XYZ and like you can be part of this and like help us do that, right? And then kind of like you know what to connect the dots to versus like just running around and like sending you random introductions, but you're like, I don't need more introductions. Like I know enough people, I just need XYZ, right? So I think knowing what to connect the dots to, I think that's a key role of leadership. And then if you can't do that, then it might be great for the individual, but not necessarily for the company.
Just another question that I was curious about also when I thought about serendipity. And maybe that's an easy one because actually it's more connected to the fundamental basic definition thing at the beginning, but still it is in my mind. What is the difference like, or is there like any connection between butterfly effect, chaos theory, and serendipity? Is there a connection, or is it a clear segments and somehow separated from each other? How is it?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how nerdy I should get here, but we actually just did a paper that uses complexity theory. So essentially that idea, right, that you have all these different pieces, especially within an organization, they're all interconnected. And one small change in one department can then kind of like become this big kind of like cascading effect, right? So I don't know, if you fire the receptionist, right? And everyone thinks, oh, it's just the receptionist. But actually then you realize, oh no, that was the person who was sharing the information that everyone always like was kept up to date. And like, they actually had the role of like the boundary spanner. And that was the best kind of like connecting piece. And now that that person is gone, now we actually are losing 5 clients because now 2 departments are not speaking to each other because actually the information flew through her or something like that, right? Where you kind of like, you don't realize that a small change can actually have a big effect. And again, that can be zemblanitous if it's a bad corporate culture, so it can go into like the negative thing, or it can be serendipitous if it's doing the opposite in good things. And so yes, huge relationship there, especially because a lot of times serendipitous or zemblanitous encounters trigger those things, right? So you might unexpectedly meet an investor and they might promise you the world. And then it turns out, right? So it was beautiful serendipity, but it turns out that they are really shady. And now they invested all this money, but like it's really shady. And now your business goes down because of that investor, right? So you wouldn't have expected that would actually happen. So it's yes. So huge effects cascading within complex systems. But I think the interesting thing here that we're essentially talking about in that paper is that the same thing that can cause you to have serendipity can also cause you to have zemblanity. So the same thing that makes you have active good luck can also create active bad luck. Give you an example. My wife, best example of, she has both a lot of serendipity and a lot of zemblanity, where she's the kind of person always last minute. So she would drive to the airport last minute, and then if there's a traffic jam, unexpectedly, she will miss the flight, right? So zemblanity by definition, like you set yourself up for failure. But also she's the person who gets stuck in the traffic jam, talks with the person in the car next door, that becomes a new client. And then she's like, I gladly missed the flight because now I have a big major client, right? And so she's the kind of person who does both. And so in her case, the risk-taking or the recklessness or whatever the kind of, recklessness is not the right word, but the over-optimism of thinking you can always make it can be good and bad, right? And so I think it's fascinating to see that the same thing that causes something good can also cause something bad, depending on the context.
No. Okay. Last question. I have one bonus question, but it's really the last one. What will be the development for the future for serendipity? Like, is it going to increase the topic? Will it become more important, or will it decline because uncertainty raises? And still, even though the people maybe listen to the podcast and read all your books and so on and say, hey, we have to incorporate that even in these uncertain times. Yeah, what will be like your future outlook for the topic? Especially maybe, I'm going to answer on that. You talked a lot about leadership behavior and also about the development of leadership behavior. And if we go back some years or centuries, yeah, the leaders were always very clear and said, okay, I know the way, I know where to go, I'm not prepared for show any weaknesses and also to confess that I have no idea where we are going for. But this is changing, obviously. Leadership behavior is changing. So my frank estimation would be like, actually serendipity, and that comes together and it will spark a further development of that topic. But is it like also what you think, also frankly thinking, or do you say no, there are some major challenges which will lead to that serendipity will be a important topic, but not like increasing in the future? I mean, I know you're biased a little bit, but still. try to make it as objective as possible.
Well, I'm biased, but also I'm a big fan of, so I'm always very hesitant to make predictions, because in most companies I work with, predictions are mostly wrong, right? And economists especially tend to be wrong, and I'm very hesitant to make predictions, but when I look at how the trajectory is at the moment, I think there's both the demand side and the supply side push, where on the demand side, to your point, right, the world is changing so fast, unpredictability is everywhere. So you have to be really good at coping with the unexpected, and you have to be good to connect dots, because that is kind of like a core competence now, right? And so there now, I think the demand I've seen personally certainly has, you know, exponentially increased over the last few years in terms of working with organizations around it, but also I think more broadly, the demand for this kind of work has increased dramatically. But then I think on the supply side, I've also found it interesting, and when I say supply side in terms of thought leadership, that what I mentioned earlier, that the biggest conferences in management nowadays have symposia on serendipity, where you see dozens of papers on serendipity being presented. You have special issues about serendipity. So that is all work that has been in the making over years, and that now has been triggering a new wave of work. So there will be so much work coming out about everything that serendipity can relate to. So it is serendipity and neurodiversity, right? So how, for example, people with ADHD might be extremely good dot connectors. So like, hey, reframing ADHD away from just being something that's bad to actually can be a superpower for serendipity if it's managed well. Serendipity and circadian rhythm, like how does sleep and energy intersect, and like how can you sleep differently or have people within the organization work differently because they might not interact with people right on the night shift, and like how do you connect them better so to also have the people on the night shift connect with the day shift, yada yada. So there's all these different dynamics that we can learn about serendipity in AI. So point is, I think in terms of the supply side, it's incredible how much will be coming out in the next couple of years of papers who have been in the works for 5-10 years. And so I think we're only seeing the beginning essentially of the research on this, even though the research has been going on for quite some time. But as you know, academic research, right, a top journal paper takes 5 years or so to go through the rounds. And so I think those kind of things are more and more coming out now. And so I think for that, so again, I'm not making a prediction, but I think I can pretty positively say that I think we'll see quite a push on that side. And also the last piece on that being, I think the more we have measures, right, like serendipity quotient and so on, the more also it's easy as a company to say, yes, when we do a recruitment, we literally ask people, are you lucky? And that's a predictor for if they will actually create good things in their job, because if they have that mindset, it makes it more likely that they will do good things. And so I think I'm very excited about what it means for HR, what it means for innovation, marketing, and so on.
I think what you just did, it's because I'm actually using the quote or the idea of connecting the dots for like now 4 or 5 months, because I was in Austin for South by Southwest, and there one major topic was about connecting the dots, or at least that was my translation, because I saw a lot of future thinkers and these futurists who are normally the guys who are making predictions, but all of them really were hesitant like you, and they said, we are not making any predictions anymore. We have to enable you and show you the framework, for example, and you have to enable yourself for connecting the dots. They sometimes use this phrase also, because connecting the dot means to see like happenings all around you, and then think, okay, what can be a consequence out of that. And I think what you just did was a perfect example of connecting the dots, because you made no prediction. You just said, okay, I can see that, and that. And if you bring all that together, that could be the consequence, but this is not a prediction from you. So very interesting also to see that live here just in front of me. So it would be it for me. And I will just now finish with my last question. Is there any addition, is there any topic that you want to raise, emphasize, or can we go for the last, the real last question?
Yeah, no, that sounds good. I think you know, we started the session with philosopher, practical philosopher. Yeah. So I do want to highlight Goethe. You know, I grew up in Heidelberg, and Goethe did some of his work there. And he had this amazing thing, like what he said, that if you take someone as they are, you make them worse. But if you take them as what they could be, you make them capable of becoming what they can be. And that's really what serendipity is about. Serendipity is about potentiality. It's about what could be, right? So if you encounter an unexpected situation, an unexpected person, and you expect a little bit more in that that could be, then by definition, more will most likely happen. And so it's almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy where once you start to see more potentiality in a person, in a situation, it starts to come out more, right? So this organization I mentioned, Reconstructed Living Labs, they work with former drug dealers. Once a former drug dealer becomes a teacher, the whole community now thinks, wow, I can become a teacher, right? And so then like people shift from drug to teaching. And so I think it's those kind of things where then serendipity happens much more because you think there's potential, there's something that can happen. And so I'm a big believer that at the end of the day, everything we just talked about is essentially about saying, how can people and situations reach their potential in the sense that we ourselves can't know. I can't know what my potential is at this given point because I know the things I know. But if I bump tomorrow into someone who knows much better what the potential could be, then I want to be open to it. And so I think that kind of, if there's one thing people take from this conversation, is really this idea that the unexpected, I know, like I get anxiety from the unexpected. Like I'm as German as everyone in this room, right? That like I don't like to be interrupted in my plans, but I've also learned that that's where the most interesting things come from. Give you a last example. When I published the book, the first American edition, my first book, it came out in the US. You have to imagine. I will never forget that. The it's crazy. It's just completely comical that. Literally, we had, you know how when you're close to releasing the book, you have copies that the publisher sends to all the major media, to all the kind of major people, and so just to kind of get initial traction. And so we had all those books in the publisher's office, and at that day in the evening, there was the total lockdown of the city, so we couldn't get the books anymore. And so like it was just like that was it. And so now, A, we couldn't send all these books, but also B, what was fascinating was that, of course, all my events and so were canceled, but actually then it became global, the book, because now it was so easy to speak at a conference in Tokyo in the morning or in the evening and then speak in Beijing and then speak there and then there. And so the global reach of the book multiplied. So for the US, it wasn't ideal in that sense, but for the world, it essentially made it possible for me to be everywhere in the world for it. And that made it truly global. And so my point here is that I think it's that kind of thing where, again, the unexpected presents itself as a negative thing, but then there's potentiality if we start to see it.
How many times do people come back to you and say, okay, you changed their lives or you changed the lives of these peoples with your serendipity research and so on? Because I really have to confess it. Yeah, this talk was amazing. It really changed my life. I can really say that to you because it's also very interesting that actually we were about to meet like 2 years ago, I think, at the conference that we were organizing, and we canceled it at the end due to several reasons. And this is why we have never met before, but still it was in my mind. And as I was curious about all these questions that I raised today, I organized this podcast today. So there's also some kind of coincidence or serendipity moment. So yeah, personal questions. How many times do people say, okay, it really changed their lives?
Let me think how I can answer this best. So it's been very rewarding to see that fortunately there is quite a bit of feedback. That's beautiful. And I think to me, the feedback that touches me the most is the feedback where it truly deeply changes someone. So to give an example, I first thought when the book came out, the content came out, that most of the impact would be for people like us who intuitively do a lot of this and then gives them a vocabulary, right? You can now go to your trainee and say, this is how you cultivate serendipity. This is a practice for you. So you can teach others. You can use it in the board meeting and saying, guys, like what I did here, I cultivated serendipity. So it gives you an active language for something you're doing. It gives you a justification for how you work, especially people who connect a lot of dots a lot of times feel they're not really valued for it. And so I think it gives them a language for it. But actually, so I think that's still something that I thrive on because I love spending time with exactly those dot connectors. But then I didn't realize that the biggest impact a lot of times comes from people who say, but this isn't me, who say, I'm the person who always has bad luck. And then actually, when they start doing small baby steps, small baby steps, they have the biggest impact. Where like initially, right, I would go into like, I always love these book readings where like you have like, you know, like skeptical kind of a skeptical audience at the beginning, and kind of like people are like, yeah, but like I'm not a lucky person, and I think you don't understand my life, and like my life is so different that you can't understand. And then like you walk through the process, and then the end, like people would be like, well, let me try this. Let me try it out. And let me try the baby step, because there's only so much I can do, right, to push it on you, but you have to try it out. And to give an example, that doesn't only apply to bad luck. It also applies to when you think you already have it all figured out. So I had a student, like a colleague in London when I was teaching there, a super eminent professor, right? Like amazing institution. And he was like, Christian, I love you. I love your research, but why would I need this? Like I have a nice family, I have a nice life. Like, why do I need it? And so we made a deal and we said, you know what? In the next couple of weeks, go out. Like when you meet people, use a couple of hooks, you know, ask questions slightly differently, do a couple of these things, and then we'll talk again. He comes back after a couple of weeks and he's like, Christian, I didn't know life can be so joyful. And to me, that's really the kind of thing that I think the only way to get into this is to do small baby steps, like going to the gym, right? But once you're in it, you're kind of like, wow, shoot, like life can be really more meaningful and more joyful. So it's not only about company performance and innovation things, but it's actually about a more meaningful life in a world that's so full of anxiety. And so to, you know, long answer to a short question, to me, the most meaningful emails or messages or so that I get are about someone saying, for example, I used to be an anxious person and I'm still an anxious person, but I've worked with my psychologist. I've had psychologists literally then sending me testimonials of their patients saying, this now gives me a toolkit to say I can navigate an anxious and a fast-changing world, because it's also overwhelming. And so those kind of moments where I feel hopefully it helps people to be less anxious about the world, especially young people. When you have a 15-year-old kid in the world we live in, like especially here in LA, it's just completely crazy. Like I think about my two daughters, I'm like, wow, like this is the kind of world, like I want you to have all the self-confidence, self-worth tools that you can get. And I strongly believe that this is the most effective way to do it. And so the long story short is, like, I get most of my joy from then reading an email from an autistic mother that says, I now reconnected with my autistic son because I previously looked at them as just like someone I have to help. But now I realize he also actually like wants to connect, and here's ways of how he connect with me differently and things like that. And so I think that's, to me, the major thing that I think also what you just mentioned, that serendipity is just an umbrella in a way for saying, let's understand how we can have more meaningful relationships and more meaningful outcomes in our lives. And then kind of like the unexpected is our vehicle to do that.
I think I cannot add anything more to that. So Christian, it's just my pleasure to say thank you to you for this great talk, this great discussion, and yeah, I'm very happy that you were here with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, and yeah, looking forward to keeping in touch, and thank you for your dot connecting. Yeah, you seem to constantly do it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Danke, vielen Dank, liebe Zuhörerinnen und Zuhörer.